Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. On our way to our conversation with Otis Raleigh, let me remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. Remember, this is a credit union. It belongs to you. It works like a bank, but it's yours. Or you can check in on steinershow.org and hit their banner, and all the information will be there as well. We are joined in studio right now, the last of our series of conversations, second round of conversations in the last month with those who would be the next mayor of Baltimore, day before the election. This time tomorrow, all of you who are citizens of Baltimore City should be voting. And let's hope you are. And now we're about to have a conversation with Otis Raleigh, who is, of course, candidate and senior manager of the Urban Policy Development, was head of planning for of Baltimore City, was chief of staff for a while in the Baltimore City government, and is now here in the studios with us. And Otis, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here, Mark. Thanks so much for the opportunity.
How are you holding up?
I'm doing pretty good.
410-319-8888 is the number here to join in this conversation with Otis Raleigh. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Those of you who have my phone number can leave messages there. I'll check that. Or check our Facebook pages. We're getting, and wherever you are, we'll try to find you. 410-319-8888. Join us here for Otis Raleigh. So, here we are, a day before the election. A political question. And then let's get into the meat of the heart of the matter of the future of the city.
Okay.
The sitting mayor has raised a lot of money. A lot of money.
Yes, she has.
Comparatively speaking. So, and you and other candidates have had a hard time towards the end raising money, getting money in your coffers. You've had to lay off some staff members. So what is your prognosis about how you're going to handle tomorrow?
Well, actually, I haven't had to lay off any staff members. But
that was a misnomer?
No, it was just not true. Yeah, there's a lot of lies out there. Not a misnomer. It's called the competition trying to say something that's not true.
So right. You have not laid off any staff members?
I have not laid off any of my staff members, no. Well, actually, we've been pretty proud with the fundraising that we've done. The reality is I'm a non-elected, unincumbent, and between January and August, I raised over $400,000. That's not done in Baltimore. It's not done in Maryland. The reality is that we had over 1,000 donors. That's not done here. And so we knew from the very beginning we would not raise as much as a sitting mayor, particularly one that is so entrenched in the establishment and so entrenched in the old guard. And so we knew that we would have to take it right to the people, right to the streets. And we've been pleased with the money that's come in. When we ask, people step up, and we don't get the numerous $4,000 checks that a sitting mayor gets. It's very true. But we knew that we had to make a dollar out of a dime and a nickel, and we've done that. We've used the money in a way that we can connect with enough voters so that we get our message out there. And I've been very pleased with the fundraising we've done.
So tell me a bit about what you, I mean, in this campaign, when we see that the mayor with his power, the incumbency, I'm curious what you're seeing out in the community, what you're hearing in the community, what the response has been to you. You're going a lot door to door.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Now we're up to a little bit over 45,000 doors that we've knocked on. We, from the very beginning, we were hearing at the doors that there was a lot of apathy, there was a lot of frustration. There were people, and we were knocking on doors of voters, Mark. So this it wasn't just any registered voter; it was voters who have a history of voting, and they were saying that they were frustrated, that they weren't pleased, that they weren't impressed, and they didn't know if they were going to vote this time, while that was encouraging because it meant that there was someone who I could reach and try to convince to vote for me, it was also a little discouraging just in terms of the overall spirit of the city, that a lot of people felt like we are at a place in which, the same old is always going to happen. So we saw that very early on. We continued to see that, and we continued to try to press, to present ideas and plans, to talk to people exactly where they are. The issues for them, Mark, was, it was education. It was jobs, it was safety, and neighborhood development, and we've continued to try to talk to those issues.
Now, one of the things I you made a couple of huge arguments in this campaign, number of them. Let me hit a few of them and see just how you flesh those out. One has to do with the police department. You said you would replace the present commissioner, correct?
What I said was that the leadership throughout city government needs to be replaced. That there's starting with the mayor, and that the new mayor, hopefully that would be me, that the new mayor has to really build a team that understands their vision, their mission, and can live up to fulfilling that vision.
But so you're not saying you would replace the commissioner.
No, what I've said throughout the campaign was that every single person who's in a leadership position in this city would be gone. That there would have to there's a reapplying kind of process that would need to occur, and in that process we make determinations as to who could stay and who would go.
All right, so let's get down to brass tacks. So what is it that you would do differently in the Baltimore City Police than is already being done? I mean, crime, at least murder rates are down. Not all crime, but murder rates are down. Many people look at the present commissioner saying that he has turned the department around, that he is making huge strides, that he is weeding out corruption. It pops up as corruption's everywhere, but he says that means I'm weeding it out, I'm going after it. What is it that you're looking for that's not in this commissioner that you would do differently?
I'm looking for the same things that I've been hearing in the streets, that I've been hearing in the communities. I'm looking for better training for our officers. I'm looking for us to have higher standards in terms of recruitment. I think part of the reason why we're seeing a lot of this corruption has to do with, you know, that the bar has been lowered in terms of who we accept here. I think the training has been less than satisfactory for our officers right now. You have folks, whether it's in Howard Park or Homeland, I'm hearing the same thing, that the officers don't know the community, that they don't really connect with the people that they're supposed to be serving. And so, you know, though I've heard that the murder rate is down.
Believe it's down?
I don't believe a lot of things that I hear out of City Hall. And the reason I don't believe them is because I've seen what has occurred throughout this campaign. I know what they're capable of. And I think it's very important that we have someone within city government who can really bring to the people whether it's true or false. What I do know is this. I know that there are a lot of honest people within the current police department. I do know that anybody in any job throughout the city, but particularly in our police department, they want to step up and do the right thing. They want sound leadership, and we're not getting that currently from the current mayor. And so part of the training piece, though, is helping them to reconnect with the communities that they're supposed to be serving. We talk always about the you know, kind of anti-snitching attitude right. That's within the city. What people forget about is that it's not just that people don't want to snitch. It's that there is not a level or a degree of trust between the officers and the community. If I don't know you, why would I tell you about an issue that could then threaten my life, that could then hurt me or my family? And so if we don't work at rebuilding that, we're going to continue to have some of the issues of crime that we have in our city.
But I mean, what you just, not to harp on this all night because we have so many other things to talk about, but that you really don't believe the murder rate is down in Baltimore? You think they're lying about this, the fudging the statistics on how many people are murdered in this city?
What I'm saying, Mark, is I don't know. I don't know what is real or not real because I do not trust the current leadership within the city of Baltimore. I don't trust the current mayor that there is a degree of accuracy in terms of what is and what is not occurring. What I do trust is what I've been hearing and seeing. I do trust that whether it's low-income or high-income communities, people are telling me that they don't feel safe, that they feel like there's a disconnect between the public safety officials and themselves. And I think a big part of that has to do with our current leadership.
Let me open the phones, and we'll go back and forth through my questions and yours. Otis Raleigh is in the House. Otis Raleigh III is going to become the next mayor of the city of Baltimore, at least get the Democratic nomination, and then have to run for the general. 410-319-8888 is the number here. You can write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to Facebook, as Zeke has already done. We'll read his question in a moment from on one of our two Facebook pages. And if you know my phone number, you can also hit me with a message, and I'll get it there. 410-319-8888. But I'm not giving it out over the air. And let's go to let's go to Hank in Baltimore. You're on the air.
How you doing today, Mr. Steiner?
Hank, how are you?
I am blessed. I'm a little under the weather, but I'm blessed.
I can hear it. Take care of yourself.
Hey, here's my question. Mr. Rowley, I really don't know you, right? I ride around the city all the time. I can pick out almost all of my elected officials if I see them on the street, right? How can you convince me that between now and tomorrow, you're the best man for me?
Well, Hank, thank you.
Wait a minute, that's number one.
Okay.
I'm gonna make sure I get off the air. That's number one. Number two, yes, I do believe with you, the murder rate is not down because, see, I'm out here in the streets, right? I want to know exactly how many unreported murders are there out there because, see, you know, almost every election time you sweep something up under the rug and you boost up, you sweep down your murders, and you boost up your arrests to make your system seem like it's working in order for you to stay in, you know, the old hide and shuffle and bait game, right? Three, what do you plan on doing as far as our children and education, right, that would step up above everybody else?
All right. Well, serious Hank, questions, Hank. Thank you so much.
And very good questions.
Otis?
Hank, thank you for your questions. Well, first and foremost, I think there are a lot of political leaders out there, a lot of quote-unquote public officials out there that you know, that if you saw them walking down the street, that you recognize them. The question is, what have they been doing? It's great that you might know their name and recognize their face, but the question is, have they been meeting your needs, the needs on your block, in your neighborhood, in your community? Have they been transforming our city? Have they been creating jobs? Have they had provided you with some serious solutions to the challenges in our city? So I'm happy you know them. That might mean it's good for you to have a beer with them. But the question is, are they in a position where they've actually made your life better, your quality of life better? And I would argue for many of the incumbents, that has not been the case. They have been in office for a long time, and longevity does not equal productivity. It can when it's matched with a high degree of kind of progressive action, but we haven't been seeing that with a lot of the incumbents, and particularly with the 17-year incumbent that I'm running against. While it's true you might not know me, the reality is I worked under three different mayors, Mayor Schmoke, Mayor O'Malley, and Mayor Dixon. And those three very different mayors hired me and gave me more and more responsibility. Each of them gave me more responsibility because I got stuff done. And so you didn't know my name because I wasn't the mayor. I was working. We all have bosses. We know how that is. But I was working. And because I worked and because I was able to accomplish things to move the city in a positive direction, each of them hired me. On the issue of education that you asked, I do think I provide some solutions that are different from other candidates. When I presented my education reform plan, the mayor and other candidates said, well, our schools are good and we're making great progress. I think our schools need to be substantially better. I think we need to be really aggressive in how we push towards education reform. And I laid out a four-point strategy. One was around returning to mayoral control. The second had to do with investing in the school buildings, that we needed 50 new or majorly rehab buildings, school buildings over the next 10 years. And I talked about how we go about doing that. We pay for it through public-private partnerships and by using the slots revenue to pay debt service on the bond so that we could move forward with that construction. I talked about opportunity scholarships for the lowest performing middle schools. And I talked about changes to our public charter schools so that the schools could be more autonomous, but also have a greater degree of accountability. Because I think the more choices that parents have, the more chances that we're going to have of people moving into Baltimore. And so I think if you go on my website, otisroley.com, you're going to, and I would even challenge you to go on the other candidates' websites. Most people won't say that. But if you do that, I think you'll see that I have the best plan as it relates to the school system.
Now, let's stay with the school system. We have a question about the school system. And Casey, we're going to come to your call next, 410-319-8888. Now, you cannot replace the CEO. The mayor cannot.
The mayor cannot currently replace the CEO, correct.
But you've also, as I've talked about earlier with Commissioner Bielefeld, you've expressed some displeasure with the administration of Dr. Andres Alonso, though some people may argue that there have been strides that the schools have made that they have not made in the last 25 years.
I would agree.
So why are you displeased with Dr. Alonso, and why do you want to see him go?
Well, it's interesting because I think a lot of what some of the voters, or at least I should say a lot of the media has tried to say, are you displeased with the police department? We should fire the commissioner. Are you displeased with the schools? You want to fire the superintendent, right? That's what you want to do, right? Let's do that right now. And it's a little silly, Mark, right? Because at the end
That's why I'm trying to clarify. Right,
I think it's a little silly. The reason I think it's silly because we could change the police commissioner today. We could change the superintendent of the schools, which we call the CEO, today, right? That doesn't fundamentally change the organization because we still have to make some substantial changes throughout those organizations if we're serious about systemic change, right? So, yes, I have been pleased that we have begun to make progress. I've been pleased with Dr. Alonso's longevity. You know, for a while there, it seemed like we were changing superintendents every 12 to 18 months. It got a little
He committed
silly,
to staying, and he's right? staying.
And so I've been pleased with his longevity. I also have been pleased with his mantra that we have to make every decision in the best interest of our children. That works for me, right? And I think he could do that much more if he had a mayor who also believe that mantra. Right? Where I have not been pleased is I want us to step up the pace. I want us to get that much more aggressive in terms of the change that we can make within our school system. There's too much disparity. Even take Madison Park in Bolton Hill. I mean, literally, in that small area, those two neighborhoods, you have some really, really strong schools and some god-awful schools, right? In that small area, right? And I just think there is so much more that we have to do as a city and as the school system to step up the pace. And I think some of it has not been done because of political realities, that there's only but so much he can do when he doesn't have a mayor that is willing to fight that battle, whether it's fighting with the unions, whether it's fighting within the school system, whether it's stepping up and standing with the parents to make some serious changes within the school system. And so that's what I'm talking about in terms of the changes that I want to make. It's not just at the top, although there does need to be changes at the top of many of our organizations. It's systemic change. And the only way you're going to have that is to have a mayor that understands that that has to occur.
Casey and Robin, can I come to your calls? I need to read this email from Zeke because it follows up on what Mr. Rowley was talking about with education. And I know, Robin, you have an education question as well, so we'll get to your question. Mr. Rowley, I have this is Zeke writing in. I have enormous respect for you as a person. Your story is inspiring, and I hope and pray that my student organizers will accomplish as much as you have. And he's the guy who organizes the intersection that had that student-run debate that you and most of the other candidates were there for.
Right. All the other candidates except for the current mayor. She didn't show up at the youth forum.
However, I'm concerned about your plan to give students in failing schools $10,000 vouchers that, quote, that can be used at any private parochial or independent school in the city, end quote. As someone who has taught in failing Baltimore City public schools, I do not understand how taking money out of an already cash-strapped budget will help to address the fundamental systemic and endemic issue of educational inequity. The research on vouchers is a mixed bag. At best, they produce some small short-term gains for students who are able to take advantage, but have a negative effect on the schools of the students who do not. My concern is that students who do not have parents that can navigate the North Avenue bureaucracy, or for that matter, students who don't have any parents at all, will be left behind. Finally, I do not know of many private schools in or around Baltimore that cost $10,000. I'd appreciate it if you could clarify your rationale for this plan.
Certainly. Zeke, first of all, thank you for your question and thank you for your comments. And let me say this. I believe at the end of the day, if someone is able to provide an alternative to allowing children to sit in a broken system while we fix it, allow them to fail and to not get the quality education that they need while we feed the system. If someone has some other solution other than opportunity scholarships, I am more than open to it. I've never been in favor of universal vouchers. I've never said that I wanted universal vouchers. I've talked about limited means-tested vouchers for the lowest performing, those failing middle schools where we're losing our kids. We are losing them. And so you talk about, okay, well, oh my gosh, what happens to the system? I'm sorry. Maybe it's because I'm a parent, or maybe it's because I've talked to too many people within my own city. But I'm not as concerned about feeding the system as I am concerned about taking care of those children. And if there is some other alternative so that we make sure that we are able to provide those children with quality educations while we continue to fix the system, I'm more than open to it. I'm not locked down. I'm a planner by training. I'm open to ideas. But no one's offered it. All they have offered me, Mark, is, oh my gosh, we can't take money out of the system because it will hurt the system.
Two quick questions on this, and then we'll move on to Casey and Robin, the next two callers up. Question one is, I mean, we're talking about $25 million you're going to take out outside the school system?
No, well, I'm not taking it outside. I am taking $25 million, which are dedicated for those children, to be spent on those children.
But you know that when you talk about taking money out of a budget, it doesn't just go directly to children. It has to do with taking care of the school, has to do with paying the teachers, has to do with books, has to do with many other things when you're talking about $25 million in a public school system.
Allegedly, right now, Mark, we're spending $14,000 per kid. Allegedly. A little bit of $14,000 per kid. First of all, I'm talking about $10,000, right, which is not $14,000 because, you know, do your math, right? So that's $4,000 that was there. I'm also talking about closing down those failing schools, right? So you don't have those operational costs. You're able to move those teachers to other schools. You don't have those book cost, allegedly, right? What you're doing though is you're moving those dollars with that child so that they're able to be to get the quality education that they need. And yes, there are numerous schools. While it might not be some of the schools that we know on Roland Avenue, there are numerous private and parochial schools that are providing quality education right now for substantially less than $10,000 per year.
Catholic schools, maybe right. Some religious schools, but not any private schools in the city. I know you can get a student there for $10,000 a year.
When you say private schools, Catholic schools are private schools.
You know,
independent
parochial schools.
Right.
Parochial schools, yeah. Maybe you can afford it, but right. You couldn't afford Gilman, Park, Friends, any of the schools.
Right. You're talking about four or five very expensive private schools. There are more than four or five of them within the city of Baltimore. Many of them are providing very good quality education to our kids. But I'm not here to fight on behalf of the private schools. I'm here, though, to fight on behalf of the kids that are in Baltimore City Public Schools. And I want to make sure that we are giving them all the tools that they need to be successful. And if there's a means to do that while we continue to fix those schools outside of opportunity scholarships, I am more than open to those solutions. But I cannot accept there are too many children failing I just can't accept that the answer is we have to feed the beast. We have to provide quality education for our kids. And if we can do that while we are fixing it, then more power to us.
Back to the phones. 410-319-8888. Otis Raleigh is in the house. Otis Raleigh, of course, is running to become the next mayor of the city of Baltimore. Tomorrow is election day. Polls open at 7, close at 8. Vote. 410-319-8888. We're talking about if you're a citizen of the city, that is. And Casey, you're on the air.
Otis. Hey, how you doing, Otis?
How you doing, Casey? Is this Casey Jenkins?
It's a pleasure, brother. You have captured me from day one.
Thank you.
I'm here for you, but I do have a question that's pressing. The current president, who also sits on the board, I know of for the slots, has put out there that they want to diminish the minority bid, the women's bid, also on being able to get some of the private, some of the funds for the slots building and everything else, the minority, the MBE bill or whatever it was. What do you think about that? I mean, 37% of the minority bid is now gone, and Donald Fry, he did a number on minorities and women by doing that, because that was an opportunity for us to grow. What would you do to help push that along to say, hey, we need to get the minority bid back in there? What are some of your plans?
Well, it wasn't I don't think it's fair to put all the blame on Donald Fry, because there's no way that he would have been able to do it without the approval of the mayor. Because the state does not have the power or the authority to restrict or to waive the city's MBE, WBE requirements, the Minority Business Enterprise or Women Business Enterprise requirements. That actually occurred at a vote August 19th on the Board of Estimates that the mayor controls. So let's be clear. The state said that they were going to loosen their requirements, and the city said we're going to waive it completely. Casey, Mark, the reality is, if this was Washington, D.C., if this was Philadelphia, if this was Atlanta, this was Charlotte, there is no way in God's green earth that in a majority African-American city that a mayor would have been able to do that and still think that they are going to win tomorrow. But she is of the belief that she can do that here because they believe that they can push through whatever they need to push through to reward those who are writing checks to them. And the reality is, in a city that's 64% African-American, you have to do more to create opportunity, economic opportunity, and access to capital than what we have been doing. And she's going in the opposite direction. A multi-million-dollar project such as this to waive the MBE requirements is just awful. And so let me say, you asked the question, what would I have done? When the state came to me, if the state had come to me and said, this is the only way that we can make this more attractive to bidders, then I would have pushed back and said, well, that's too bad, that this cannot be waived. It's a crucial part of the development package, because the reality is, for Baltimore, we have to open up opportunity, economic opportunity, for more Baltimoreans. Otherwise, the city can't grow.
Casey, thanks so much for your call. Good question. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Let's take a quick break. We'll come right back. As soon as we return from this break, we'll go right to Casey. So hold on. I mean, Robin, in Baltimore. We're going to come right to your phone call. On the way out, let me remind you, though, before we go out, that Morgan State University will host acclaimed author, physician, and activist Dr. Nawal El-Sawadi for a series of lectures, interviews, and community discussions from 6 to 8 p.m. on Thursday, September 15th, 2011. Her visit is the headlining event for the Morgan's Distinguished Lecture Series. Newsweek lauds her as one of the 150 women who shaped the world. Her writings denounce women's oppression everywhere. The event is at Turpin Lamb Theater in the Carl J. Murphy Fine Arts Theater. She'll also be on our program tomorrow night. And she is just one of the most amazing women on the planet Earth, a leader for democracy and rights, and will be probably nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. So you don't want to miss her. We'll be right back with Otis Raleigh, who's seeking to become, not the Nobel Prize, but seeking to become mayor of Baltimore. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is made possible in part by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. It's a simple way to stay connected to the topics and events you care about most. Daily contents on arts, culture, food, design, style, green living, and much more can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. And today, at the end of the second hour, we have another one of our Urbanite Radio stories, so stay tuned for that. Otis Raleigh's in the house. He has served three mayors in different capacities. He was head of planning under
O'Malley,
and he was chief of staff for Sheila Dixon.
Correct.
Left before administration got into whatever, and is running to become the next mayor of the city of Baltimore. He's senior manager at Urban Policy Development. 410-319-8888 is the number here. And Robin, you're on the air.
How you doing?
Hi, Robin. Welcome.
I was listening to you, Mr. Raleigh, and
how you doing, Robin?
Fine. Your question or your platform on education, well, it all sounds good, but building structures, how would that curb the dropout rate or the testing scores or making children stay in school longer and excel to where they need to excel to go into college? Then my other concern is, I haven't heard you talk about anything about the housing situation that we have in Baltimore, the homelessness, and Ragnar Straub, he should have been gone 15,000 years ago. But I haven't heard you talk anything about helping the homeless or the housing situation that we have.
Well, Robin, thank you for your questions. On the education front, the 4 points of my education reform plan, you're right, it does not include kind of changes to the curriculum. And the reason why it doesn't is because ultimately, even with mayoral control, you don't really want your mayor running your school system. You want accountability to the mayor, and then for the mayor to be accountable to the people of Baltimore. But ultimately, what I want to do is to hire the top staff to move forward with a strong curriculum, to think through kind of ideas as to improvements that we can make within the school system, to work with us to map out strategies to attract teachers, to retain teachers, to train those teachers, and to equip those teachers with the resources that they need to better provide for our kids. And so that's why what I tried to do, lay out in my education reform plan, was to hone in on the issues that at that higher level, at the mayoral level, the things that a mayor could directly impact. And so that's why you have not heard as it relates to those other pieces. On the homeless piece, I do lay out a strategy as it relates to dealing with the vacant buildings within our city, and the changes that I want to make to try to move more people into homes, to create more housing choice within throughout the city of Baltimore. I recognize that we have seriously mismanaged our housing and community development resources within the city of Baltimore. There's a desperate need for new leadership and for a refocus of our housing community development and our public housing agencies. I mean, the current mayor's own transition team said this to her almost, what, 18 months ago, that the Housing and Community Development Agency had forgotten about community development and it wasn't doing the housing piece that well. And yet, you know, she didn't take any corrective steps. She didn't really move us in a direction where we began to address it and address the needs of the neighborhoods, both those who are currently housed there and those who are homeless and need housing choices and options. So I think the mayor, Mayor Dixon's 10-year homeless plan, the plan to reduce homelessness and to end homelessness within the city of Baltimore, was an aggressive one. It made a lot of sense, and unfortunately, it was abandoned under the current administration. I want to kind of update it and revamp it and really put our energy and efforts in it. And I also I want to do more as it relates to working with some of the private and nonprofit partners so that we can start to change over a lot of these vacant properties and put them in the hands of homeowners, regardless of income type, because right now it can take up to 3 years for us to move a vacant property into the hands of someone who wants it.
Robin, thanks so much for calling. Answer your question.
Has something good. If I could vote three times tomorrow, I would. But at this point right now, I am so, you know, instead of browbeating each other about what they're not doing, what they're doing, I need some clear answers because I want to vote for somebody and when they get in office, what they said or what they passed on, it don't happen.
All right. But so,
that's what everybody says. I'm voting. So it discourages me.
Robin, you were breaking up a little bit. I think we got a lot of what you were saying. And I think a lot of voters are discouraged. A lot of people in Baltimore are discouraged. People think they have no power to affect anything because of the way the power structure works, that their lives don't seem to change. And so, consequently, you get fewer and fewer people who are voting on Election Day, at least in Baltimore City and in many cities like Baltimore.
I think it's true. I think what it's interesting, the Baltimore Sun did their endorsement last week. And they talked, you know, obviously they endorsed the incumbent, and that wasn't a big surprise to a lot of people. But it was interesting how they, when they talked about the other challengers and even how they talked about the incumbent, they said, you know, she lacked vision and she was kind of managing the decline. I was like, okay, so why are you endorsing her? But it is what it is. And then when they talked about me, they said that I had vision. They said I had laid out the most kind of comprehensive plans on how we address some of the issues within the city of Baltimore. They said I understood the interrelationship between education and recreation and crime and public safety, blah, blah, blah. All those things, Mark. And then they said, though, but we think he's a bit politically naive if he thinks he can push against the establishment. And I thought that was really interesting. Mm-hmm. Because basically what they were saying to the citizens of Baltimore, they were saying to me and other citizens of Baltimore, was like, yeah, we think he has vision. We think he gets it. We think he can fix things. But if he thinks he can push against this monster, this beast, this machine that has profited from our dysfunction, he's delusional. He's naive. Well, I'm hoping tomorrow that a lot of people say, you know what, we're not delusional. We're not naive. You're not going to trick us to keep voting in people who have been doing what they've been doing. You know, yes, there is an establishment. And I think many of them within the establishment, they believe that the pie can't grow. And so they are comfortable and set in their ways. I don't believe that. And I don't believe it, not just because I'm idealistic, not just because I've been knocking on so many doors. You know, I don't believe it because I know I look outside of our city and I look within our city. And when you look outside of our city, we see other cities have gotten it. They realize that to grow your city, you have to actually invest in those things that are going to be attractive to families. You know, you have to invest in schools. You have to invest in rec centers, you know, even in a down economy. Because you want to create an environment where neighborhoods are attractive to families, both those who are currently there and those you want to attract. And the establishment might not get that, but I think the citizens of Baltimore do. The apathy that Robin was talking about, the apathy that you were just talking about, it has occurred because we keep electing the same old, and then we scratch our head. We're shocked. I mean, Mark, think if you had continued to date somebody who broke your heart, you know, who didn't treat you with respect, you know, how can you be shocked, you know, that she doesn't treat you right? You have to change course. You have to move towards someone who's a new relationship. And you know what? Even if that relationship doesn't work out, then guess what? You drop that zero and you get with someone else.
Let's return to the phones. Otis Welly is our guest. He's running to become the next mayor of the city of Baltimore, 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to the Mark Steiner Show webpage. Hit me any way you can, and we'll get your questions on the air. And Brad in Hamden, you're on the air.
Thank you, Mark.
Welcome.
Thank you. I'm a big fan and supporter of yours. I think you're fantastic, and I cannot wait. If I had a chance to vote three times tomorrow, it would all be for you.
Thank you.
The question that I have is this. We have far too often these problems get bogged down in this sort of narrow-minded fixation on the ground at our feet, or even the ground just a few feet behind us. What are we going to do about this problem? What about that problem? What about this legacy of yesterday's bad decisions? Can I ask you, as one of the few people running with real creative vision, just talk for a second. What are the strategic opportunities for Baltimore? What are the things that remain untapped that are unique to us in our position that would allow us to build our revenue base and our tax base, allow us to build our population? What are the things that we need to capitalize on rather than just hand-wringing about how we screwed things up yesterday and the day before? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you. Brad.
Thank you, Brad, for your question. And I appreciate it, and I wish you could vote three times. And though you can't, I hope you talk to two other people and get them to vote.
Vote early and often, right?
Right. But let me say, I've talked throughout this campaign about our assets, the assets of Baltimore, right? That, you know, we have 11 colleges and universities that we really have not tapped into. We have billions of dollars of research funds that come into our city. And when many of those colleges and universities move their ideas from an academic pursuit to a commercial one, they move those ideas, those commercial pursuits, outside of our city. And it would be frustrating enough if they move those ideas outside of the country, but often they move them to Montgomery County, to Howard County, to Baltimore County. So it's not even that far away. And I think part of that has been that the city of Baltimore and the municipality, our economic development agents, haven't really recognized that as a real asset that you can manage, that you can partner with, and create opportunity for Baltimoreans in terms of job opportunities and just economic opportunities. So that's one huge asset. I also think that though the port is obviously run by the state, it's an asset of the city. Right? And there are a lot of port-related services that we don't concentrate on. And that we don't invest in that would help our overall kind of local economy. I talked a bit about this in Live, Earn, Play, Learn, a comprehensive plan that I did when I was planning director in the Earn section, and just recognizing that the port is a great economic engine that the state touts, but that the city really doesn't recognize what we could and should be doing around investing in small and mid-sized businesses in and around the port, doing more to create job opportunities, particularly because there are many jobs that are kind of low-skilled jobs that only require a GED or high school diploma, that we could do a better job of connecting individuals to those employment opportunities that we haven't been doing. And I also, finally, I think the city of Baltimore, just in terms of the physical assets of our parks and infrastructure in our neighborhoods, there's a kind of a physical diversity in terms of our neighborhoods, with literally some neighborhoods you can stretch out your left arm and your right arm and you're touching your left and right wall. And then there are other neighborhoods where you have rolling acres in the front and in the back. Baltimore is awesome. It really, really is. You know, and I think if we understood that more, as a city, if we had a mayor that understood that more, I think we could do a better job of marketing it and figuring out how to better invest in those neighborhoods so that we bring more people into our city.
410-319-8888. I have a question. Let me get another phone call in here. A bunch of people have called in. 410-319-8888. Otis Waller is with us. He's running to become the next mayor of Baltimore. Tomorrow is the election. And Keith, you're on the air.
Good afternoon.
Hi, Keith. Welcome.
I wanted to ask Mr. Rowling, if he could tell me what was the cost, what did it cost the city to have the...
Have the what?
Downtown Baltimore. What did that cost, and what is your opinion about it?
Keith, hold on a second. We didn't hear what you... What were you asking? What cost... What were we talking about downtown?
The auto racing that just...
Auto racing. Gotcha. We lost you. Right. Your cell phone went out when you said auto racing before. Okay.
Yeah, Keith. I don't know actually the total cost of the event. I know that the press has asked and people have asked, and we've haven't really gotten the final number in terms of how much it costs and city resources beyond the road work. In terms of the staffing that had to occur, the police, all those things. I'm not aware of it, not because the question hasn't been asked, but you know, there's a lack of kind of access to information and transparency currently that I hope to change if I get the opportunity to serve as your mayor. What I do know is this. entertainment options are great for a city. The Preakness once a year is like having a Super Bowl once a year in your city. It's great. What I took issue with as related to the Grand Prix was not the race, but just in terms of our priorities. I felt like our priorities were out of whack in terms of there's so much need in our communities and our neighborhoods in and around the harbor. They talked about this being about changing our image. And I thought it was a little silly to say that. I think if you want to change the image of Baltimore, then how about you start stepping up and investing in the neighborhoods of Baltimore? You want to change the image of the that's portrayed in The Wire? How about you invest in those neighborhoods that are portrayed in The Wire?
But what does that mean? If you're a mayor, what does that mean you're going to invest? I mean, every mayor has talked about this. Few have done it, anything really to make it a dent. Right. So what do you mean invest? Well, how would you invest in our neighborhoods? How would you invest in the desolate parts of the Councilmatic district that have no grocery stores, that where people are just one of the districts that sends more people to prison than to school? I mean, so what would you do?
Well, there's a lot of things I want to do. Particularly, how do you invest in neighborhoods? You actually lay out a plan or a strategy depending on the neighborhood, right? So let's take a desolate neighborhood where there's a high level of vacancy, right? If you have a block where there are 2-3 occupied properties, the strategy for that block really is demolition, right? That you need to move those individuals who are living on that block, right? Try to keep them within their own the existing social network, because even with such high vacancy rates, there's still relationships and healthy relationships that often have occurred when people have lived in neighborhoods for a long time. Right? But you knock down that block and you create, whether it's creating urban gardens or passive parks or urban farms, right, within the neighborhood, but you tear those buildings down because you cannot keep chasing after vacant upon vacant. There are other neighborhoods where it's mostly occupied, where you only have 4 or 5 or 6 vacant properties. In those neighborhoods, then you use all the forces and tools that you have that can be brought to bear to invest in those vacant properties and to create and to fill those vacant properties. You see it happening in Union Square, right? You see it happening in other parts of the city where once you change the focus instead of accentuating the negative, but thinking through of how do I invest when there's some people who have already laid down roots, then you start to create change. We have not had a clear strategy. You say other mayors have talked about it, and you're right, but none of them have laid out plans to do it. Right? They say it during campaign season. They may even have cute commercials that talk about it, but none of them have had a kind of thought out plan on how do you go about doing it. And I think it's the first time in the city's history in a very long time where you've had a mayoral candidate, hopefully to be the next mayor, because I hope to be the 50th mayor of Baltimore, Mark. And 50 is a year of jubilee in my faith. If you is able to actually lay out a strategy and then wants to implement it. Even if you disagree, as you've heard, some people disagree with some of parts of my education reform plan. Some people may disagree with parts of my neighborhood plan. Even if you disagree with it, doggone it, isn't it good for once for us to have a plan that we can move forward with in terms of how we budget, how we allocate human and financial resources? And if we need to tweak and change, then we'll do that. But to go in blind, to follow to chase after one developer after the next instead of thinking through how do you create a climate where multiple developers, whether they're billion-dollar developers or small-time developers, want to invest in our neighborhoods. And I think I've provided us with the opportunity to do that come September 13th.
410-319-8888, Otis Rawley seeking to become the 50th mayor of the city of Baltimore. Max in Hamden, you're on the air.
Hi, Max.
Hi,
how are you guys? I just had a quick question about property tax. I've been living in the city for a few years now, and I really think that, the main thing I hear from my friends is, why not move to the county? Property taxes half the rate as it is in the city. So I was just wondering, what's the difference between you and the other candidates on the property tax issue?
Well, first of all, there are only really two candidates that have laid out real plans as it relates to property tax reduction. As you know, the current mayor's plan really is relying on revenues from the slots, and it's just not realistic. The senator has said that she is going to pull together a commission to look into creating a plan as it relates to tax reduction. So there are two options here. There's mine and another candidate who has looked at a 5-year-old kind of blue ribbon committee that really lays out a strategy to increase a bunch of other taxes so that you can reduce the property tax. what I've talked about doing is over the course of 10 years, very responsibly and reasonably, looking at how do we reduce our property tax burden in our city to get it down at a level that is comparable to the county. The first 2 years of my plan, when I'm mayor of Baltimore, would be to it would really be focused in around revenue enhancement. So I start, you know, taxing vacant property, taxing blighted property, and taxing blighted land at much higher rates than what we currently do. 5% for blighted land, 10% for blighted property. It's worked in Washington, D.C. I believe it can work here because a large portion of the vacant land in our city and the vacant property in our city is held by investors, investors who they have patient capital. But I don't have patience. The neighborhoods don't have patience. And so what I want to do is to really help to create an incentive for them to do one of two things. They either need to develop the property and put it back into active use, or they need to get rid of it, whether that's giving it to the city or to someone else who wants to develop it. People didn't understand when the governor, then mayor, I guess kind of still mayor, was looking at the Project 5000 initiative. What he was focused in on then was he was saying, look, if I have to board this stuff and demolish this stuff, I need to actually control it so that I can help to move it in the development process. I think those investors, if they don't want to do anything with it, if they want to get rid of it, it gives us an opportunity, not a challenge, but an opportunity to do something with it.
Now, you just made an aside when you said the governor still mayor or something like that. You really believe that he still runs the city? Do you really believe that Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake does not make her decisions that they're being made in Annapolis for her?
Yes.
Do you believe that?
Yes, I do.
Not a political partnership that where one hand washes the other because they both supported one another for a long time?
No, I do not.
Why?
I think the proof is in the pudding. I look at her career. I look at her track record. 17 years, right? The last 18, 19 months as mayor, the years prior to that, there weren't any initiatives. There weren't any plans. There wasn't any action. There's a claim that she was a council person and therefore that she couldn't really do stuff. Mark, you and I know there are tons of council people who bust their butt, who work actively and hard for their community, who use their role as a council person as a bully pulpit. They push against the system. They create opportunities. So that's no excuse. I have not seen any degree of leadership in which she has stepped out and stood up and done anything. She has throughout her career had the benefit of a name and of the establishment. I've had to work since I was 13, so I have a different reality.
James just wrote it on Facebook. Please ask Otis why he does not support marriage equality.
I believe in civil unions. I do not believe, whether you call it marriage equality or whatever you try to frame it as, I believe that marriage is between a man and a woman. But I believe that that civil unions should be universal in terms of the city citizens of Baltimore, citizens of the state, the citizens of this country. That it is unfair to limit the ability of anybody who's entered into, whether if they're a taxpayer, they should have the rights of every other citizen in terms of entering into a contractual agreement. And at the end of the day, a civil union is really that.
So even if a church agrees that they want to perform a religious ceremony, all churches wouldn't have to, but those who would agree shouldn't be allowed to have a religious ceremony to marry people of the same sex?
First of all, the mayor of Baltimore cannot marry anyone, as you know, it's a state function.
Support it as a mayor,
yes,
or not
yes,
support it,
or not support it. And I don't support gay marriage. I support civil unions.
410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. We have a question we've asked others that actually came from Christina, our producer, which was, what are your thoughts on the campaign for fair wages in the Inner Harbor? Do you believe that we need to give developers tax breaks and subsidies to attract them to the city? Do you agree with placing requirements for a minimum wage, some would say a living wage, fair working conditions and benefits for workers at businesses that receive city money?
And Mark, the person's name was what?
Christina.
Christina, I think, Christina, I would ask you, please check out my website, otisrowley.com, and pull up the Rebuilding Baltimore Government plan, because early on, actually it was the first position paper that I put out, I talked about how important this was and changes that we needed to make. Also, if you pull up my economic development plan, I also talked about this, that yeah, there is no problem whatsoever with providing incentives to developers and to businesses to do work within our city. The problem is when those incentives are not in the best interest of your population. So, yes, I firmly support tying those incentives and tying loans and grants that come from the city to job opportunities for city residents, and to making sure that those job opportunities have fair wages for those people who are working for those businesses and developers that are doing work in our city.
Now, there was a controversy surrounding you and your wife and payroll in the city. All right.
Yeah. Well, actually, it was less of a controversy and more of the old-time Baltimore politics. My wife used to work for the city of Baltimore. She took a job working for the council president. He sought her. He asked her to come to work for her, for him. She said to him, you know, Jack, my husband's running for mayor. Will this be an issue? He said, no, we're separate offices. He's not running for council president. I don't have an issue with it. And she did a phenomenal job. She was the director of community outreach and constituent services. She went out on maternity. The mayor tried to pressure the council president to remove her from office. The council president pushed back. When my wife left for maternity leave and the campaign started to heat up, when she came back from maternity leave, a week after she came back, she was called in by the council president and told that she needed to take a leave of absence because the mayor didn't want her there. And it was too much pressure on him. It seemed like he might have been supporting me if she was there. She did not want to take a leave of absence, and she told him, well, just fire me then. If you want to fire me because of the mayor, fire me. And he, of course, was smart enough to know not to do that. He said, no, you need to take a leave of absence. And she said, I don't want to. This went back and forth, and he said, look, Charlene, you have more than enough leave. Just take a leave of absence. Charlene checked. She checked to see how much leave she had. She checked with the Department of Human Resources as well as with her own HR person. They said she had more than enough leave to take off. So she took, you know, so she was forced to take this leave. The day after, I could have dropped out of the race. July 5th was the date. Of course, I didn't drop out because we're going to win tomorrow. The day after, a letter was sent to us saying, oh, the city made an error. You owe us $26,000 and we want it now. Right. And according to our policy, if we make an error, you have to pay us back. Of course, we thought it was a little convenient that it came the day after the dropout day. And, of course, we brought it to an attorney. If at all it is true, we will pay the money back. But we don't believe it to be true. We think what it was more to try to scare me out of the race. And when they couldn't get me out of the race, they tried to go after my wife.
We have about a minute and a half left. So a closing thought to our listeners, to your voters.
Baltimore, tomorrow's election, I think, is one of the most important elections in recent history in the city of Baltimore. You have a real choice that you're going to be making tomorrow. And it's the mayor of Baltimore is a real job. I want the opportunity to serve you as your next mayor. I love the city. I have three children and a wife who we live in this city. We attend public school. This city matters. And you need a mayor that knows that it matters and knows that the people of this city are worth fighting for. I hope you give me the opportunity to serve you. I hope you come out and vote. The polls are open from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. It is going to be a beautiful day tomorrow. And what a beautiful day it will be if tomorrow you elect a mayor that's going to work for you, not against you, but for you. My name is Otis Rowley. My website is www.otisrowley.com. If you want to volunteer, if you want to help between now or even tomorrow, 410-338-4036. Give me the opportunity to serve you as your next mayor. And I promise you this, I am not a career politician. I am not going to spend time faking the funk, campaigning and doing those things that don't matter. My office will be downtown, but my work every day will be in the neighborhoods.
Otis Rowley, good luck tomorrow.
Thank you so much, Mark. And thanks for the opportunity to come on.
It's always good to have you here. And we'll see what happens tomorrow. See you tomorrow night, wherever you are.
Hope to see you at my victory party.
Tomorrow night. Otis Rowley has been our guest. He's running to become the next mayor of Baltimore City. Let me remind you all, vote. If you're a citizen of Baltimore and registered voter, vote tomorrow. It is critical. A critical election. Get out there and push someone's button and vote. Support for WEAA is provided by the Enoch Pratt Free Library. Presenting Boston Globe reporter Sally H. Jacobs, author of the book The Other Barack, The Bold and Reckless Life of President Obama's Father. Monday, September 12th at 7 p.m. at the Central Library. More information at prattlibrary.org. See you down there. And we'll be right back in a debate, conversation about the President's Jobs Program with perspectives from the liberal side, the conservative side, and from the left. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Support for WEAA is provided by Strathmore, presenting singer-songwriter-guitarist Keb Mo. It's Keb Mo, a living link to legendary Delta bluesmen. Thursday, September 15th at Strathmore. Keb Mo, performing selections from his latest release, Reflections, a soulful stew flavored with blues, jazz, and R&B. Tickets available now online at strathmore.org. Strathmore is located on Rockville Pike, off the 495 Beltway, and a few steps from the Grosvenor Strathmore Metro. And members like you. Thank you.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, where we analyze daily hard-hitting news stories that matter, from war and peace to government policies and struggles for justice. Democracy Now! Provides perspectives that are rarely heard in our country. We bring the world to you. Join me and Juan Gonzalez on Democracy Now! Weekdays at 8 a.m. right here on Public Radio WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community.
If you want to know your history, you can find it in jazz music. Sterling Brown, the Dean of Negro Poetry and Literature. I'm Doc Manning, host of In the Tradition. We will pursue, define, and broadcast what Sterling Brown said some time ago every Monday night from 8 p.m. to 12 midnight here on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community.
Morgan State University Public Radio, 88.9 FM, member-supported, community-approved, WEAA, Baltimore.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and in the first part of the next hour, at least a good majority of the next hour, we're going to be talking about President Barack Obama's jobs bill, the perspective from the trade union movement, perspective from a conservative think tank, perspective from someone who doesn't fit into either Republican or Democratic sides. So it should be interesting. So you want to stay with us for that. First now, we have to take this over to WEA traffic for all of you listening in the Baltimore metropolitan area to find out what's going on the roads, then come right back to our conversation. So please stay with us.
Support for WEAA is provided by Luna, offering flooring, carpet, hardwood, and laminate flooring. Information at 877-241-LUNA or luna.com.
Good afternoon. This traffic report is brought to you by Caltrade. Seeing that slowdown on the Beltway. Let's start there. Inner loop between Wilkins Avenue and Security Boulevard. Outer loop York to the Harrisburg Expressway. And then slowdowns on 95 northbound, Route 32 to 175. And 70 westbound, Columbia Pike to Marriottsville. No problems for you continuing north on 95 to White Marsh. You do have some crashes in the city. Washington Boulevard at the Beltway. Also Liberty Heights at Reisterstown Road. Bel Air at Rock Spring. Then Lock Raven at Pentwood, a crash. Also Hillen and Cold Spring. You will see Hawkins Point at Efficiency Way, structure fires, so expect some road closures in that area. For more information, log on to SigAlert.com. I'm Jamie Sullivan, Baltimore Area Traffic.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Marlene and Stuart Greenebaum Cancer Center, an NCI-designated cancer center providing research, treatment, and education to further the prevention of and cure of cancer. Online at www.umgcc.org, or the number for information is 1-800-888-8823, or you can go online to steinershow.org and click on their banner, and the information for the University of Maryland Medical System is right there. We're going to talk about the state of the economy, what Barack Obama, our President of the United States, suggested to the country and his state to the state of, not state of just the union, but his address to the country at a joint session of Congress. And we will outline it, talk about it, and debate its efficacy and what it can do for us or not do for us. We have joining us today Corey McCray, past president now.
Yes, sir.
No longer president?
No longer president.
I like that. Past president of the Young Trade Unionists and labor blogger at www.corymcrae.com.
Yes, sir.
John Duda is in the studio. He's communication coordinator for the Democracy Collaborative and a member of Red Emma's Bookstore Coffee Collective. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mark.
Joining us by phone is Dr. Jim Doran. Jim is vice president for academic affairs at the Cato Institute and professor of economics at Taos University. And Jim, good to have you on the show.
Thank you.
So let's talk about this. What we heard yesterday, I'm curious what your reactions were. And folks, by the way, join us. 410-319-8888. We have a metropolitan area where the unemployment rate in some parts of our community is just off the charts. East side of Baltimore County, parts of the west side of Baltimore County, the city itself. And he was talking to you. And I'm curious to see if you agreed or disagreed with what you heard the president say and what you think should be going on here. 410-319-8888. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to my Facebook page. Either one of them, Mark Steiner Show or Mark Steiner. And or you can hit me on my cell phone. But if you have it, you can send me a message there. 410-319-8888 is the number here. So here we have this bill that a couple of things and what people were saying about it. One was some people were saying that they were shocked that President Barack Obama actually came out swinging as hard as he did. They didn't expect that because they haven't seen a swing in a while. That was for some people were throwing out there. But what he did in this piece was to clearly state that what he wants to do is invest billions of dollars in infrastructure, billions of dollars in $35 billion to retain and hire teachers, $30 billion to refurbish school buildings, $50 billion to repair highways, railroads, transit, and waterway, a $4,000 tax credit for those employers that hire people who have been out of work for 6 months or more, and payroll taxes cut for the first $5 million of a business payroll. Could give there's another one he talks about, $62 billion to extend unemployment benefits through 2012, $140 billion, as I said, for infrastructure development. He's talking about the payroll tax, continuing that and deepening it, making it greater for working people and their paychecks, and also helping companies out in that as well. And kind of amorphous, non-identified cuts in Medicare and other issues like that were put on the table. So your analysis of what you heard, and let's just go around the room. Let me start with Jim Doran and then go to John Duda and Corey McRae. Jim?
Well, you know, the objective is very good, to create jobs. Unfortunately, we've already spent over $800 billion on the stimulus program, and it hasn't created very many jobs. It's interesting, the last report that came out in August, there was no net job creation, no net new job creation. There were jobs created in the private sector, but there were jobs lost in the public sector, and they netted out. So if it were just a question of throwing money at something and creating jobs, that would be nice. But the problem is somebody's got to pay for this. And we're already running huge government deficits for the next 10 years. They're trying to reduce that. They just passed a bill to that effect. And now the president wants to spend another half a trillion dollars, roughly, you know, that we don't have. So I'm all in favor of trying to create wealth and economic growth. But I think the way to do that is through permanent tax cuts, through lowering government spending over time, and getting rid of some of these onerous regulations, and perhaps reducing the minimum wage rate for teenage workers and having it lower than for adult workers. Because the law of demand holds in the labor market just like any other market. If you increase wage rates arbitrarily without any change in skills or anything, people are going to lose jobs. And the huge unemployment rate among minority teenagers in particular is atrocious. So I'm all in favor of creating jobs, but we have to create economic growth, and I'm not sure the Obama plan is going to be the best way to create economic growth.
Jim Duda.
Well, I mean, I think there's definitely some good things in this plan. It was definitely refreshing to hear Obama come out and say some things that needed to be said, to say that we need to decide where we're going to cut, what we're going, you know, who this is going to bear the brunt of this crisis, and whether it's going to be the most vulnerable or whether it's going to be the most well off. And certainly today, when we saw the White House announce their proposed funding for this, it's actually stronger than it was initially led to believe. Right, the Medicare cuts seem to have gone off the table, which is interesting. At the same time, this plan doesn't really go that far. You know, for a jobs bill, there's really remarkably few jobs here, right? If you look at it, Only about a third of the proposed $440 billion is directly going to job creation. A lot of it is preserving existing jobs. A lot of it is extending unemployment benefits. And this is necessary, right? We're in the middle of a serious crisis. We have 25 million people. If you look at the highest numbers of unemployment calculations, right, the ones that include the discouraged workers, the people who can't find enough work, the so-called U6 numbers, right, there's about just under 25 million people unemployed, right? If you look at the people who are the so-called 99ers, the people who are have been unemployed for, more than 99 months, right, who are running out of benefits, right, who have nowhere else to turn, there's 2 million people in that position, right? So we're in the middle of a serious crisis here. And there's some good stuff in this bill. Infrastructure is good. School upgrades are good. Stabilizing neighborhoods is good. These are probably the best parts of the bill, probably the most likely to get cut as this gets negotiated and chopped up. But I would think we would need to go further.
Well, trade union, speak up.
Well, I'm always excited about speaking. But, Mark, first let me say thanks for giving me the opportunity, as always, to share a conversation, share a dialogue. But when I heard the president, it was a great feeling due to the fact that he did take that position. It was a strong position, but what we want to see is some type of action behind it. I'm very glad because he actually gave unemployment a face that night. You know, it's a lot of people out here screaming and yelling and wanting their voice to be heard, but nobody's there to listen. So those people that, such as he said, in reference to the 99ers or different things like that. So the tax credits for the veterans, the tax credits for the people that have been unemployed the longest, I think was a great position. Investing in education is so important, not the infrastructure of education, the teachers in education, and also the infrastructure in the roads and in the schools. But at the same time, I listened to what Mr. Jim said, and he talks about the minimum wage, but I think that the infrastructure is a great piece because when in the federal government, you get to have Davis-Bacon laws on it, so we know that they're going to be paying a good living wage. We know that they're not they're going to have some type of health care, and that's what a lot of jobs are offering right now because it's an employer market. They're not offering health care. They're offering them $10 an hour, and I think that weakens the economy instead of stimulating the economy. And then when you talk about paying for it, I think that it pays for itself because once we start spending or get more money in the people's pocket, the consumers' pockets, then they'll be spending at the grocery store. They'll be spending on the extra items or the necessities that they need. Some people are not even being able to get the necessities that they need. So those are the things. I think that it pays for itself. And then I've been hearing a lot of the talking heads talk about the payroll tax cut, you know, taking away from Social Security. But at the same time, you have more people working, it's going to be adding to Social Security. Just look at if we stick to what we have now, it's less income coming in. But if more people are working, then you can afford to cut that payroll tax for a certain amount of time.
410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Your thoughts on how to get the economy revving. What are the stories in your own life? What do you think should happen? Maybe you're a small business owner. Maybe you're a very large business owner. I don't know. But maybe you're a small business owner. Maybe you're a union worker, a non-union worker, somebody who's lost their job, somebody who's dealing with mortgage payments. What are your thoughts on what you think it should be? 410-319-8888. And let me ask you, and Jim, a moment ago, when you spoke about a couple of things, we talked about the $800 million stimulus that happened at the beginning of President Barack Obama's administration, at the end of George Bush's administration, when the economy really tanked and the explosion hit, or the implosion hit, I should say. And you said the $800 million didn't do anything to stimulate or grow jobs, and I think very few people would disagree with that. Right, left, or middle, but many people would say, well, that's because that $800 million stimulus went to bail out the banks, Wall Street, the largest companies, and did nothing to stimulate the economy by doing something to create jobs. Because it did all go to bailing out the banks, right?
Well, yeah, the bailouts didn't certainly help people, that were losing their jobs at regular businesses and so forth. It helped the financial industry, and now we're facing huge problems again with the financial industry.
Yes, we are. Look at Europe.
So that's not over yet, but there's been studies done that show that stimulus spending was very wasteful because it was costing roughly about $280,000 per job, it's been estimated, to create those jobs, which doesn't make any sense at all. With respect to the Davis-Bacon Act, I'm not a big fan of that act. That means that you have to pay construction workers on federal projects the prevailing wage, which is typically the union wage, and the union wage is much higher than the competitive market wage for the non-union construction sector. I think the taxpayers deserve to to have competition and to pay a wage rate which is market determined, not determined by the government. That increases construction project costs tremendously. You look at this American Reconstruction Recovery Act that's been in existence since the financial crisis. I drive into Washington down New York Avenue. They've been trying to repave that for 3 years now, and they haven't even finished it. They repaved all of Beijing for the Olympics in about one summer. So you don't wonder where all this money is going. We've thrown a lot of money down a rat hole. So there's no question that extra spending would create jobs. But again, the way to create jobs in the long run is to match workers with jobs and get them better education and so forth. So if the minimum wage, were really helping create jobs, it would be great, because all we have to do is double or triple the minimum wage and people would be richer. But the trouble is, the employers aren't going to hire them unless they're more productive. And the big tragedy today is the education system for the inner city kids in particular. There's no competition. There's no voucher system for the most part. They have to go to schools where kids are getting shot. So if they can't get a good education and build up their own human capital, their lifetime income is going to be very low, and then they're going to get despondent and not even look for a job, go into drugs and so forth. And this is a serious, serious problem. And President Obama's program really doesn't address that. We've seen the riots that they had in England, and a large part of those riots were disgruntled youth. So we've got to address those problems over the long run. And simply spending money that we don't have is not the real solution. We've got to reduce corporate income taxes, reduce regulation, get rid of some of these tariffs on imported parts and components that jack up the price of goods in the United States and don't make us as competitive as we could be and create as many jobs. My colleague Dan Eikenson just had an excellent article in the Wall Street Journal on Friday arguing for that. So I think those are things that we can do. Unfortunately, we can't do them overnight. And in a $15 trillion economy, it's not like a machine, especially the job market. We need what we need, I believe, is flexible labor markets. Europe's labor markets have never been flexible, and their unemployment rate as a result has been much higher than ours. So you have to be able to fire workers as well as hire them, and you've got to get rid of these regulations, especially on small businesses. And I don't know how to do that, frankly, overnight. We can promise things to people for jobs and everything, but we would like to create jobs from the private sector, not for more bureaucrats.
Go ahead, Corey.
It's several things that I would like to touch on with Mr. Jim, but I'm going to touch on three of them. I'm going to touch on the Davis-Bacon wage. I'll touch on the tariffs that he was talking about, and I'll touch on the minimum wage for young kids, lowering the minimum wage for young kids. Well, first, me being a person that actually got to enjoy the benefits of working on Davis-Bacon projects. A Davis-Bacon project is where a union and a non-union companies turn in a survey to the federal, state, or local level to state what the wage is that they're paying their workers. So that's a medium wage that's given by the construction companies. Now, the non-union can turn it in. It's not just a union wage. It's a medium wage that's gathered off of the information and the government puts it in. That's why I like the regulation, due to the fact if we didn't have that regulation, then we all would be in poverty instead of just maybe the non-union workers. Another thing that I like to touch on is the minimum wage. Lowering the minimum wage for kids is like, what do you want us to go back to? China? I think that everybody would agree that we shouldn't have to take our country backwards. China should catch up with us. So us being in this world economy, it's not us that's doing wrong. Us making a good living wage, having health care, having a good retirement when we retire is not the wrong thing. I think that the people, China, exploiting young people, sending lead over to our country every time, having no rules and regulations is the problem. And I think that we need to challenge them to get at their best. The third thing I like to talk about is the tariffs. I disagree with saying lowering the tariffs for more imports to come in. I think that we actually need to raise the tariffs on them and actually have – that makes us more competitive, and it makes us – companies be able to do better business and get to the consumers of the people that's going on in our country. Every time I see something that's made in China or made in Japan, it's kind of frustrating, because I know that that's a job that could have employed an American employee.
Okay, Jim, and then we'll, John.
Yeah. Oh, I think Corey said a lot of what I was going to say, but I think what I would touch on would be the issue of deregulation. I mean, we have to remember how we got here, right? We didn't get here because, we had greedy workers who were demanding too much money, right? We got here because we had a massive financial collapse. We had a system of, our economic system in this country was massively deregulated, and it fell apart. And when it fell apart, it took a lot of people's lives with it. And that's the systemic problem here, right? This is not just – and this is my issue with the bill, is that it doesn't seem to acknowledge the fact that there is something seriously wrong with the way the economy is structured. The idea is that you can just kind of like turn these knobs, you know, get some more money flowing through the system, and it's just going to come back to life. And maybe that's going to keep it on life support, right? But we need to start thinking about systemic alternatives, right? We need to think about how we build jobs and what kind of jobs we build. And I don't like some of the kinds of jobs that are being proposed here, right? I don't like the, for instance, the no-wage training jobs that are being proposed where you're on unemployment, right? This is the part of the bill that inspired by the Georgia Works program, for instance, right, where you have these jobs which are essentially, you know, free labor for people, right? I don't like jobs where there is, you know, where we're basically talking about cutting wages as far as we can go, cutting rights as far as we can go. What I like is the kind of jobs that we work on in Cleveland with the Democracy Collaborative. We have a pilot project out there where we're trying to build real jobs, right? We're trying to build worker-owned jobs in green industries, right? And that stuff is it's a small project, but it's an interesting project because what we're doing is finding ways to actually build long-term solutions, right? Not short-term solutions, not just extending some benefits, not just priming some money into the economy and hoping things get better, but really trying to rethink how the system is put together and what the logic of the system is. And when we spend public money, right, when we bring private money in to create jobs, what kind of jobs are we building? Are those jobs that are minimum wage, below minimum wage? Are those jobs that are, or are those jobs, on the other hand, jobs that have an ownership stake, jobs that are in industries that are strategic, that we want to develop, that are going to help us address not only an economic crisis, but an ecological crisis? And that's the kind of thinking that I didn't see in this bill.
Let me open the phones here, 410-319-8888. John Duda, who is communications coordinator for the Democracy Collaborative, is with us. You just heard him. Coy McCray, past president of Young Trade Unionists, and labor blogger at www.coymcray.com. Jim Dorns is a professor of economics at Towson University and is vice president for academic affairs at the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C. 410-319-8888. Your thoughts. Seymour, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi,
how's everyone doing?
Very well. Great. Welcome.
Okay, Mark, great show.
Thank you.
I just have a question. Can your guest tell me what the profit margin is for a government job, Davis-Bacon Act job, for the employees compared to a private sector job as far as the employees are concerned? Because what I need to know is, why is it that guys, construction workers, who get on a Davis-Bacon, a scale job, okay, a Davis-Bacon Act job, make more money than if they were on a regular job? And what does that company that they work for, what's their profit margin? Because from what I understand, their profit margin is a lot smaller. But the employees, the people doing the work, they make more money. And when they make more money, they spend that money in the supermarket for their rent, clothing, and all that other kind of stuff. They are happy. Tell me any guy, any woman, who would want to be on a job in the state of state of Maryland, like the city of Baltimore, would they rather work on the campus of Johns Hopkins, or would they rather work on a campus of the University of Maryland, for example? I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Hmm.
I'd definitely like to comment on that.
Go to a gym.
And Mr. Seymour, just to elaborate, for union workers, for electrician, I'm a union electrician. All jobs are scale jobs to us due to the fact whether it's in the private or the public. I've worked on the aquarium. I worked on the Norfolk Grumman. I've worked at John Hopkins doing construction, putting lights in and running wire and putting pipe in. So all jobs were scale. It was the non-union people that wanted to get on the scale jobs because they weren't making that amount. And they knew that their employer would they paid almost half of what we made or somewhere two-thirds of what we made. So in reference to a public-private, I want to say that it's probably the same profit margin, but I can't speak for a business, you know, due to the fact that I'm not the union company. But I never want to bad mouth or beat up the employers that's doing the right thing. I think that when whether you're on a private sector job or a public sector job, paying a person, an American, a good living wage, having health care, and having a good, a respectable retirement is not the wrong thing. I think that, you know, anytime we practice or preach anything else, then we're promoting race to the bottom tactics, and that's what's killing our country.
Let me ask Jim if you would jump in here before we go to break. And I one of the things that somebody said, you can answer this question that the listener brought up, and you heard what Corey said. And I was talking to somebody the other day who is a very wealthy person who's in business. And they said, none of us with lots of money are going to keep our money unless there's a strong middle class to buy the stuff that we're making. And so he was worried about capitalism falling apart. He said, because nobody's going to buy the stuff that I want, that we make, if nobody's making a decent wage. So I wonder how that fits into what you were speaking about in terms of your thinking, your analysis of how our economic system should work.
Well, look, let's think in terms of the minimum wage, or if you want, let's look at the minimum wage. People seem to think a higher minimum wage is better, but the problem is you got to distinguish between the wage rate, which is a price, so many dollars per hour, and in a competitive market, you're paid what you can make in your next best alternative. The employers are not going to pay you more than what you're worth, basically, in terms of your productivity. Your productivity depends upon your education, depends upon your acquired skills, your motivation, etc. So if the minimum wage is, let's say, $5 an hour, but you can only produce $4 an hour, you're probably not going to get a job at $5 an hour. Now, if you don't get a job, then your income is zero. Whether the minimum wage is $5 or $10 an hour, if you don't get a job, your income is zero. So what we're talking about, we want people to have high real incomes. Now, if they can't get a job because they're pricing themselves out of the market, because there's two sides to the market, then their income is going to be zero. So you got to ask yourself, is the minimum wage the right way to help the poor, let's say? Well, why are the people poor? Because they have low skills. They may not have opportunities. There may be barriers against entry for them into certain professions. That's what a union is. A union is a barrier to entry, and unions in the past have discriminated before the civil rights laws against minority groups. And the unions force the employers to pay a higher wage rate. If they don't get it, they'll go on strike. Now, in right-to-work law, states, which are the fastest-growing states in terms of jobs, including Texas, you don't have that problem. And what I disagree with is Davis-Bacon basically does force construction projects to pay the prevailing wage, which is typically the union wage, if you look at the data. And that's going to cost taxpayers a lot more money because they're the ones paying for the federal projects. These are not private projects. So people have more money to spend, but taxpayers have less money to spend. So there's no net gain there. This is silly. The way jobs are created is either through the market, through voluntary exchanges. FedEx has created many, many jobs. It wasn't the government. If you look at the jobs the government creates, it's totally different. It's a taxpayer's expense. So you've got to talk about either market-created jobs, which obviously you're going to have creative destruction. There's going to be jobs created and jobs destroyed all the time. That's the nature of the world. And the world's much more dynamic today than it was 20 years ago, so you have to accept that fact. The U.S. is never going to be having the old steel mill jobs and things that when I grew up in Buffalo, where I worked one summer. So you got to accept that reality and ask, how do you improve the job markets? You have to have economic growth, and we don't have any economic growth now. That's why we don't have any jobs, because we don't have any economic growth. How do you stimulate economic growth? I agree. We have to have changes in institutions. We have to have more transparency. We have to, during the Great Depression, one of the reasons for the huge loss of jobs was because government failure, government policy. Monetary policy in particular, they let the money supply shrink by a third, and then they imposed all types of controls which made labor markets very inflexible. So we've got bigger problems to look at in terms of how we structure the economy to allow flexibility and individual responsibility and free choice and competition. That's what I favor.
I'll let you guys come back and respond. And we'll take a short break and join us here at 410-319-8888. And I'm going to come back with another question about where jobs are created. From what Jim was saying, you heard Jim Dorn, Vice President for Economic Affairs at Cato Institute. John Duda, Communications Coordinator for the Democracy Collaborative. Corey McRae, past president of Young Trade Union. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Support for WEAA is provided by Strathmore, presenting singer-songwriter-guitarist Keb Mo. It's Keb Mo, a living link to legendary Delta bluesmen. Thursday, September 15th at Strathmore. Keb Mo, performing selections from his latest release, Reflections, a soulful stew flavored with blues, jazz, and R&B. Tickets available now online at strathmore.org. Strathmore is located on Rockville Pike off the 495 Beltway and a few steps from the Grosvenor Strathmore Metro. MyAmazingRoots.com, providing paintings and illustrations of Africa's ancient kingdoms, Zulus, Mandinka, Ashanti, and ancient Egypt, and many others. MyAmazingRoots.com helps preserve African heritage for generations with archival fine prints. Posters and fine art t-shirts are also available. More information at MyAmazingRoots.com. And members like you. Thank you. The second annual WEAA Gospel Grace Legends Concert is Sunday, October 30th, 6 p.m. at Murphy Auditorium, featuring the living legend, Lady Tremaine Hawkins. No one can change my life complete. Change. And now I sing. Change. I sit at my side. Lady Tremaine Hawkins live in concert with the Morgan State Choir, along with other special guests. Don't miss Lady Tremaine Hawkins, live in concert with the Morgan State Choir. Sunday, October 30th, 6 p.m. at Murphy Auditorium. Sponsored by WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and the Morgan MBA program. Have you noticed how much you rely on the Mark Steiner Show to bring clarity to the day's local news? Well, we're here to remind you that WEAA relies on you to keep programs like the Mark Steiner Show on the air. A gift of any amount makes a big difference in our ability to pay for the programs like this one you count on. Please call with that gift now in support of the Mark Steiner Show. 443-885-2075 or give online at weaa.org.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. On the way back to our conversation, I'm going to remind you that Morgan State University will host acclaimed author, physician, and activist Dr. Nawal El Sawati for a series of lectures, interviews, and community discussions from 6 to 8 p.m. on Thursday, September 15th. Her visit is a headlining event for the Morgan's Distinguished Lecture Series. Newsweek lauds her as one of the 150 women who shake up the world. Her writings denounce women's oppression everywhere. And by the way, she'll be a guest in this show tomorrow night. And is also one of the people being thought of as being nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize. An amazing woman. The event will be held this Thursday night, 6 p.m. at the Turpin Lamb Theater in the Carl J. Murphy Fine Arts Center. We have with us here today in our studios, Corey McRae, who is past president of the Young Trade Unionist, works for the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. He's a labor blogger at www.coreymcrae.com. Dr. Jim Dorn, you heard before we went to break, is Vice President for Academic Affairs at the Cato Institute and Professor of Economics at Towson University. And John Duda is Communications Coordinator for the Democracy Collaborative and a member of the Red Amos Bookstore Coffeehouse Collective. Number here is 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. And so it doesn't feel like it's everybody's jumping on here. Let's just let Jim respond to this, and then we'll go back to the phones.
John.
Right. Jim, y'all should – too many J's for me today. Go ahead.
Well, one thing I think is interesting
– sorry about that.
Jim mentioned FedEx creating jobs, right? And I mean, if you think about it, you know, there's a lot of infrastructure that FedEx depends on, right? They can't create jobs without the infrastructure, the transit infrastructure, right? FedEx does not build their own roads, right, to drive their trucks on. FedEx does not run their own airports, right? We have a lot of public subsidies, right? And we have a lot of infrastructure for the economy to take place. And, you know, that's why I'm excited that the jobs bill is saying, okay, we're going to rebuild the infrastructure, right? We know the infrastructure in this country needs to rebuild. We know we can't have a productive economy without a well-functioning infrastructure that's not, you know, 10 minutes away from falling apart. But it's interesting to look at how that's going to happen. So, for instance, there's going to presumably be a lot of money spent here, you know, billions of dollars on mass transit systems, right? We don't build rail in this country, right? We don't build railway cars. We don't build trains. That's all foreign companies. So there's like one tiny company out in Oregon that builds streetcars, right? Other than that, and a little bit of like final assembly work, all of that money that's getting pumped into the economy for transit, right? Well, it's going to help us by building infrastructure, but that money is ultimately not going to stay where it needs to be, which is in the communities that are hit by this crisis. And that's some of the thinking that I would want to see here, right? Like, how do we build an economy not just that does what we need to do in the short term, but actually long term reorients our priorities and builds real forms of wealth within our communities?
Let me open the phones again, and then I have specific questions about this bill and where it might or might not take America. 410-319-8888. Leon in West Baltimore, you're on the air.
Real quick, a couple of things I need to have explained that I really don't understand. It seems like over the past 10 years or more, wages have been flat, while corporate profit, at least prior to the collapse, were running pretty high. So it seems like they were not rolling those things over into higher wages for employees. Yet at the same time, to offset that, the consuming power of the average middle class person was buttressed, it seems like, by the easy extension of credit, partially reflected in the housing bubble, which of course had to come to an end. Now, it seems like if we've already had some market manipulation, so to speak, with, extending the concept of some corporations and entities being too big to fail, even though they have made some gross miscalculations and sometimes bordering on criminality, shouldn't there be some sort of redress on the worker side to up their level of income so that it reflects the opportunity to amass real wealth? Thank you.
Interesting point. We can either start with Jim and go to Corey or the other way around. Jim, you want to start and then we'll go to Corey?
Yeah, I think he makes a good point. The Federal Reserve kept interest rates too low for too long, but it was compounded by Fannie and Freddie and then by all these derivatives, that they were selling on Wall Street, packaging these mortgages. But Fannie and Freddie bought those things and, you know, no interest loans, no documentation loans. And that's what got us into trouble. So it wasn't just the private sector. It was the government sector, too, with these government-sponsored enterprises and monetary policy that was misplaced and lack of any regulation on the on those types of mortgage, those derivative instruments in effect that would prevent fraud. Look at the fraud that took place and everything. So certainly he's correct on that, but the overconsumption, so consumers were consuming a lot more than what they were making in wages. Their real wages were kind of increasing slowly or stagnant in many cases, but they could borrow. They could get a lot of credit, and that's what happened. And the government was the same way. It was overspending, didn't have the money. And we're paying for that now, and that's what's happening in Europe, and that's what's going to put a damper on the job market. You know, it would be nice if we could just help the private sector by reducing taxes, but we're running these big deficits, so we have to reduce spending as well. We're living way beyond our means, and that's going to take some time, unfortunately. So there's no magic wand that's going to solve this problem overnight. So, and as far as trade goes, what we want to do is the purpose of trade is not to create jobs, to create wealth, and jobs are created and destroyed all the time. We want to create jobs that have net benefits to the consumers. If they can buy cheap goods abroad, they have a comparative advantage. Consumers save, and they use the money to buy U.S. products there where you have a comparative advantage. And I mean, that's the whole idea of trade. The idea of reducing tariffs on component parts, on industrial inputs, means that it would be cheaper for U.S. firms to make products, and that would create jobs in the United States, not destroy them. So it's backwards to think that having tariffs is going to create jobs. It's not. Likewise with energy. I mean, we've got tremendous energy to tap, but regulations in some cases are onerous. So I'm in favor of regulations to prevent excessive pollution. And by excessive, I mean pollution that is costing much more than what it's worth. What I mean is that you don't want zero pollution, because 100% cleanliness would not make any sense. We want the amount of pollution that we can afford to control. A rational approach to it. Trade-offs. I mean, that's the nature of the world. Sometimes groups aren't willing to make trade-offs. So we have to take into account all these things in terms of talking about a rational approach to job creation, I think.
We have about 5 or 7 minutes left, so let me let Corey come in here before we have to move ahead.
I think that Leon referenced a good point, the stagnation of workers' pay and the growth of CEOs and big businesses' pay. That was a good key. And that keyed on two of Mr. Jim's points was lowering the minimum wage or not ever raising the minimum wage, and also the taxpayer. And when you talk about minimum wage, the companies that's paying minimum wage is a company such as a Walmart, a McDonald's. And I always see a new McDonald's or a new Walmart popping up. And why can't they pay a good living wage? What's to say that these people aren't making trillions of or billions of dollars, and why they can't pay a person a good living wage, health care, and a respectable retirement? And then we touch back on the taxpayer. When he said that Davis Bacon or any type of thing that pays a good living wage is bad for the taxpayer, I would beg to differ, because if you're the taxpayer, you're actually going to be paying a double bang at the same time, because those people in poverty, they still collect some type of food stamp, some type of housing voucher, some type of subsidy to equip them to be able to stay. So I think that putting money in workers' pockets is always the answer.
So let me, very quickly, we have about literally 4 minutes left for the segment, because we have to move on to another segment. But the question is, some people argue that the tax breaks themselves to businesses, these tax cuts, will actually not create jobs. It's nothing to do with creating jobs. And some people argue they do, payroll tax cuts, I mean. And the other is people who are arguing that, and we can do this the next show, is that the argument whether massive infrastructure, say we're calling $200 billion a year for the next 25 years, is what's needed to fuel the private marketplace and the public. Very quickly, let me just turn to John, maybe 2 minutes, and then 2 minutes to Jim, and then we have to roll. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think these tax cuts, they probably will have some effect, right? They probably will help create some jobs on the margins of some situations. Some of them will probably just be pocketed. We've seen certainly that corporations are interested in and the owners of those corporations are interested in increasing their wealth at the expense of larger society pretty clearly. So I don't think those are going to – if they have an effect, it's going to be a small effect. It's not going to be enough to employ all the people that are unemployed. It's not going to be enough to really affect this crisis. And I do think the infrastructural improvements are absolutely necessary. But I do think they need to be done in a way that makes sure that they work to build our capacity and our economy and the wealth that stays within our communities.
And very quickly, I would turn to Jim Dorn. Jim?
Well, we had a big infrastructure project up in Boston, didn't we, the Big Dig, and that was a fiasco. Yes, we want infrastructure, but remember, the government doesn't have to do it. In Chile, I was just in Chile, they have a lot of private roads that were built as private investments, and the tolls go to private companies. They did a great job building it. So I want infrastructure built that has a net benefit to society, and the markets can determine that. What? So we shouldn't just think that if the government doesn't do it, nobody's going to do it. So yes, infrastructure, but we need institutional infrastructure as well as the pavement and so forth, and we've got to get the government back down to size, and we got to lower taxes to encourage businesses and investment in the United States to create jobs.
Well, I think that what we need to do is start at this point in the next week or so, come back conversation about infrastructure development, the future of the economy, and where America should go, and let's have a rip-roaring hour with a bunch of folks, and maybe you all included. And I want to first to Jim Dorn, Vice President for Academic Affairs at the Cato Institute and Professor of Economics at Towson. Great to have you on the air, Jim. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
John Duda, good to have you here.
Thanks, Mark.
Communications Director for Democracy Collaborative, a really great project we've covered before, and member of Red Emma's Bookstore Coffee House Collective. that make a good peanut butter sandwich and a good cup of coffee and lots of other things as well. Corey McRae, past president of the Young Trade Unionists, labor blogger at CoreyMcRae.com, and an organizer with the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. Corey, always good to have you in the studio, man.
As always, thanks for the invite.
We're going to take a very brief break. There's a holiday celebrated nowhere else in America but right here in Maryland. It's called Defenders Day. Why? What is it? It's an Urbanite Radio story. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Don't go away. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555, or you can log on to the SteinerShow.org website, and when you do, you'll find the Maryland Housing Community Development banner. Click it on. All the information is there, as well as information on how you can buy a house in Baltimore City for almost nothing, and they'll back it. Now it's time to buy. So, but now we're talking about something else. We have one of our Urbanite radio stories, a piece written in this month's Urbanite called Mad Dogs and Britons, In Search of the Roots of Defenders Day and a Cold Beer in Edgemere. And one of the authors of that piece was Jim Meyer. You say Meyer or Mayer?
Meyer.
Meyer. I'll let you be a Meyer.
Excuse me?
We'll let you be a Meyer.
Thank you very much. It's worked for 38 years. I'd like to keep it up.
So this holiday is celebrated nowhere else in the world but here in Maryland.
Yeah, just Maryland. It celebrates the defense of Baltimore during the War of 1812. Some would say the saving of the country. Just here.
So, but you took a journey.
Yeah.
Through the east side of the metropolitan area, mm-hmm. in search of people who are dead.
Yeah, pretty much. We never found them either.
So tell us about your journey.
Well, you know, the British Army, after burning Washington, D.C.
And what year are we talking about, though?
That was 1814.
1814.
At the end of the August 20-something.
I have it here because it's in your article, but go ahead and keep talking. I'll figure it out.
August
24th, the British burned Washington, D.C.
Yeah. And, you know, after that, they headed up to Baltimore.
Burned Bladensburg on the way?
They burned Bladensburg on the way into D.C.
Oh, in the way to D.C., okay.
Yeah, the D.C. defenders just fled. The defenders at Fort Washington just saw the British Navy and bugged out. The president was on the run. Dolly Madison had, some of our greatest treasures, I guess, under her skirt and was hightailing it. And, you know, the British Army came and picked a fight with Baltimore and never made it here. And I thought, I've got this old British car. Maybe I can do something for British pride and get the old Jaguar from East Baltimore all the way to Fort McHenry.
You're not talking about a 2012 Jaguar, though.
No, it's an 86.
That makes a difference.
Yeah. Right. The pinnacle of British engineering. Just.
So anyway, you went on this journey.
Yeah, I took a historian, and we just basically drove through. The British Army basically landed in North Point, came up old North Point Road, and made a left on Philadelphia Road, which is now 40, and made it all the way to basically the edge of the eastern edge of Patterson Park when they were stopped by the British Army or the American Army, and simultaneously they were bombing Fort McHenry and having the national anthem written and all that stuff. But so we drove along and interviewed people along the way to see what we could find that was still there and
what was still there. not much.
Not much. There's a battlefield that's just sort of a quarter acre of semi-mowed lawn in Dundalk. And we found the third oldest war memorial in the country, which is was built by this guy's unit that was killed, a killer Randall. And it's just in somebody's front yard on old North Point Road next to a drainage ditch across from a tarp repair store, which I don't know who repairs tarps, but
Now, there, in all seriousness, this particular holiday, which is a is close in, to the cockles of Governor Martin O'Malley's heart.
Mm-hmm.
He just loves this holiday.
Yeah,
he's almost obsessed by this holiday.
Yeah, and there's a lot going on. He started the bicentennial, the Star Spangled 200 Maryland Bicentennial Commission, and they've got a lot of events going on in the next 2 years. I guess you know, this weekend there was a lot of events at Fort McHenry and down in Dundalk as well. But and there's, I guess, a PBS movie premiere coming up in a couple of weeks. It's going to be aired on PBS, but they're having the premiere down at on the 26th of September down at the movie theater at the Harbor. I can't remember what it's called.
Oh,
Harbor East.
Harbor, right.
Yeah. So
Landmark.
That's the one.
Right.
You can get a drink and watch the British invasion.
That's great. That's the only way to watch an invasion.
Exactly.
With a drink. this particular battle, I found what is interesting. I knew just a little bit about it. I never paid much attention to it. But this general, this British general, was it?
Robert Ross.
Robert
Major
Ross.
General, yeah.
And he was leading this crack troop of British soldiers mm-hmm. after they ransacked D.C. and what is now the D.C. suburbs, making their way to Baltimore. But he was shot and killed by two young teenage privates.
That's the story, anyway. Who actually killed him is unknown, but since that day, people have been saying
these cats were hung for it.
That was a mistake in my story, actually.
You made a mistake in
they
your story?
They were actually shot. they were not hung.
Oh, but they were killed for it.
They were killed.
They were killed.
They were killed. Yeah, there's two kids, 18 and 19. There's also some debate about how old they are, but their graves as 18 and 19. Henry McComas and Daniel Wells, they're buried down at the corner of Monument and Gay. There's the monument there. That's where their bodies were exhumed to. And, these two kids basically, essentially, might have saved the country. I mean, this was like the most powerful military force on Earth was marching towards Baltimore, the second wealthiest city in the country, after having burned the Capitol. And these two kids with, I think they had like 30 some rounds between them, were sent out to fight the British and managed to kill the leader of British forces in America.
In all seriousness, though, I mean, this particular piece about this war, this was a war that most people thought was stupid to start with, but it started anyway, 1812. Mm-hmm. And New England threatened to secede at some point. They were angry mm-hmm. about the war. But Baltimore, which you just said, was a powerhouse.
Mm-hmm.
It had the largest free black population of any place in the United States of America in these 13 colonies, and defended itself with these less troops than the Brits had.
Mm-hmm. Initially.
Initially.
Yeah.
Then that grew to like 15,000, new articles?
Correct. There was 5,000 or so, 4,000 British Army, 1,000 British Marines landed in North Point, where basically they outnumbered the American troops about 2-1, who fought and retreated, and just bought time for the defense is to be built basically right where the pagoda is. That's Hampstead Hill in Patterson Park.
That was the battle line. So the cannons in Patterson Park are those cannons, correct?
Yeah, there was basically 15,000 troops entrenched there with their cannons and waiting for the British Army when it got there. And some British gunboats came into the harbor to try and eliminate the defenders the night before, but they were unable to do it. And there's a lot of people think that if Ross hadn't been killed, the British would have pressed on and tried to take the city. He didn't have a lot of respect for American troops, but with his death, they turned back and saved the city.
So, what made you want to do this story?
I grew up in East Baltimore, and I remember one of the first things I remember was my dad taking me to see the reenactment of the Battle of Baltimore, or the Battle of North Point, when I was a little kid at Ballastone Mansion, and I don't know. It just always had kind of a soft spot. And there's these two kids, you know, two 18 and 19-year-old kid who arguably is responsible for the fact that there's a United States as George Washington or anybody else, and nobody knows their name outside of a couple of streets in Baltimore. You see McComas Street somewhere. And
that's who his name for. Who knew?
Yeah.
I didn't know.
Yeah, a lot of the names of streets downtown, like they were in Asquith Street. That was Asquith Rangers was the unit they were in. That was the unit of sharpshooters.
Uh-huh.
It's you know, the seal of Baltimore is the battle monument, you know, that's that thing on the flag,
and the seal on the sheriff's department is the seal for that battalion or something like that, right?
That's one I don't know.
I read that somewhere else.
Yes, whoever said that was very smart.
Yes, but the seal in the sheriff's office is that seal.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's basically entwined in the fabric of the city, and it's you know, based. The War of 1812 provided a lot of Baltimore's greatest moments. There's also,
but what you didn't do was you didn't solve the mystery of who really killed the general.
No, and I've gotten hate mail from both sides saying it was definitely McComas and Wells. It was definitely a killer Randall. And, you know, the historians I've talked to say we don't know. A killer Randall is another.
Right.
He was in a unit of engineers who was also credited. His unit claims he did it. And then the rest of the. But I've been since reading up the history of Defenders Day and the history of the holiday itself. It started 1816 was already officially being recognized by the state. But more people died in some of the reenactments than died in the battles. Because these old guys would get in their uniforms and march from downtown to Edgemere and back and just be keeling over. And they would have a fake battle, but they would be so drunk that they would often actually shoot each other.
It is so wild that what they do is, here's a battle that kind of broke the back of the British in 1814 and won the war for America. But all we remember is there's not like Battle of North Point, like it's a Battle of New Orleans song. Mm-hmm. That battle was fought after the war was over.
Well, we do have the national anthem, so we did get that song.
We did.
It's not a country classic from the 50s, but... You know, it's got a little credit.
So, Jim, any last tidbit before we go?
You know, if you're there's a lot of activities coming, and check out starspangled200.org. And next year, on Defenders Day, this day next year, there's going to be ships in the harbor, British fireworks. It's going to be pretty exciting.
Jim Myers from town right here in Eastside. He's a comedian. He's author of Mad Dogs and Britons, In Search of the Roots of Defenders Day and a Cold Beer in Edgemere. This August issue of Urbanite Magazine, one of our Urbanite radio stories and conversations. And Jim, good to meet you again, and good to have you in the studio.
Thanks for being here, having me here.
Yeah, I have to be here. Folks, thanks all for listening very much to our conversations today. We'll have more for you in the coming week, a lot of interesting things coming up. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Cricket Aronson and Justin Levy. Our intern today is Mike Norris. We're engineered by Akisa Gunn. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, and hear new additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9. Oh, wait a minute. Look, who is that over there? It's Martha Reeves Jews. She's coming on next. WEAA's newest host. She'll be here in a minute. Stay tuned for her. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MECU, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development.
Support for WEAA is provided by the Shakespeare Theater Company, whose D.C. premiere of the Broadway musical Fela hits the stage September 13th and continues through October 9th. Produced by Jay-Z, Will Smith, and Jada Pinkett Smith, Fela the musical is based on the life of legendary Nigerian-born musician Fela Kuti. Tickets available now at shakespearetheater.org. Fela, his story inspired a nation, and his music inspires the world. And members like you. Thank you.
Hi, it's your girl Cheryl here to remind you that you can check out What's Hot for the Weekend every Wednesday through Friday in the mornings at 10:35 a.m. and afternoon and evenings at 12:35, 3:50, 8:35, and 10:50 p.m. Listings of live music, concerts, exciting theater, community festivals, professional gatherings, and more on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community.
Hi, I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Every day on The Takeaway, we report the latest news, then bring in experts with the background needed to really understand the stories we're covering.
And then we mix in your voices, everyday people who are affected by what's happening.
Wake up to all the news of the day with context. Join our live conversations.
On The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International. The Takeaway, weekdays at 6 a.m., only on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community.
The following is a public service announcement from WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community.
The Little Patuxent Review invites poets, writers, and visual artists of all hues and cultural corners to respond to the call for poems, prose, and visual art related to the theme of social justice. Works that explore principles of equality and justice, human rights, or that touch on the dignity of all are requested. More info at littlepatuxentreview.org/submissions. Great music and in-depth news and information form National Public Radio, which attracts sophisticated consumers and business decision makers. You can reach this highly desirable audience with your company's marketing message on WEAA. Isn't it time to make our listeners your customers? For more information about underwriting with WEAA, call 443-885-4508 or